Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a podcast on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Paul Robichaux, professor of English at Albertus Magnus College in New Haven, Connecticut, to talk about his new book, Pan, The Great God's Modern Return, just out 2021 with Reaction Books. Hi, Paul. How are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
Absolutely well. I got to read a really cool book this morning. So I spent my day with a great book.
Good.
Yeah, it's a really nice way to start to spend a day. So, speaking of this really great book, the first thing I want to sort out is how you came to write it. So I got to tell you, when I do these, it's usually very clear to me when I'm getting ready to talk to an author. I take a look at their CV and their publications, and I'm like, oh yeah, clear trajectory, dissertation, publications, career, book under discussion. Your path is not as easy for me to sort out, however. So I want to ask some questions to kind of get to this. So first off, you're a poet, yeah?
I am. I don't know if I would call myself that. I think that I have published some poems. I'm still writing. I'm trying to put together a sort of longer thing. Like a lot of aspiring poem writers, I'm sending stuff out and occasionally get an acceptance. So that's kind of that side of things. My academic background, I started out in English and I wrote on an Anglo-Welsh poet and painter named David Jones, who's not really well known on this side of the Atlantic here in North America, but he's a really fascinating writer and he draws a lot on Celtic myth and Arthurian legend and so on. So I've always had a real fascination with myth and the way myths are kind of adapted and reimagined made contemporary for their time. I had been getting a little frustrated, I think, with academic publishing. I teach a lot at my college. It takes a very long time to even put a relatively short article together for me. And I felt like I wanted to bring something a little more creative to my kind of prose writing. And I happened to be reading some D.H. Lawrence just really for pleasure and was thinking about Pan and the way he brings Pan into some of his stories and essays and things and in some interesting ways. And I think that connected for me with Kenneth Graham's Wind in the Willows, which was one of my favorite books growing up. And The Piper at the Gates of Dawn was always a really magical kind of experience for me reading. And I just got to thinking it would be really interesting and fun to write about Pan and kind of trace out the way he's been imagined and thought about over the centuries. And no one had really written a book, a full-length book on Pan since the 1960s, looking at his role in literature and so on. So it seemed like it might be a fun project to undertake. So that's kind of how I came to that.
Yeah, this makes sense. I can see that. And I know like when you're thinking about how the medieval and ideas of the medieval are used in kind of 20th century poetry, there's something natural there that works. I want to put a pin in Kenneth Graham. I want to come back to him in a little bit. But so I would like to start a little bit back. And I want to go like kind of one of the things that struck me here is like the wide variety of sources, you know, Kenneth Graham, which is pretty modern, but starting with Hesiod, right? And Robert Graves, this poet Zoe Brigley, who I know now because of your work, one of the most important books of my lifetime, Jitterbug Perfume, right? Like is a very cherished book to me. So there's this massive array from the kind of like the dawn of writing until yesterday, of just writing that you used, plus a number of other like visual sources and plays and et cetera. How did you go about selecting this massive, like these works from the massive amounts of pan in the world?
that's a really good question. So I think one really helpful starting point was a book I sort of alluded to, Patricia Merivale's book, The Goatfoot God, which came out in 1969. And she has a really wonderful bibliography, and she talks about a lot of things. But I also, so I drew upon the texts and writers that she talks about, but I also followed up some hints, I guess, in her book where she doesn't really go into a lot of detail. And it required a fair bit of research, and some of it, you know, was done during the lockdown and everything. So I relied at certain points on Google but also just kind of drawing on some of the books and writers I was familiar with and I found interesting. I was writing to a word count, so I couldn't include absolutely everything. So I tried as much as possible to find a balance between, myth and literature and painting and getting some geographical range as well. Aiming, particularly as we get closer to the present, aiming for, some gender balance too, in terms of the writers and so on. So, it was a lot of reading, a lot of kind of following up hints and footnotes and things like that. But it was a lot of fun. It was really fascinating seeing all the different ways and forms, in which Pan had been imagined. So, a lot of reading around, a lot of Google searching and just kind of really immersing myself in that whole world.
I can imagine a lot of rabbit holes. I mean, you're going to get to comic books. You mentioned comic books. So.
Yeah. And that was fun. I mean, I collected comics back in the 80s, and it's been a long time. I still have my collection somewhere around here, but it was kind of fun to kind of jump back in and read some of those classic Wonder Woman stories from the 1980s. And, one of the fascinating things about Pan is that he's always had this kind of wide appeal. It's never, even though the classics generally have been associated with kind of elite culture, you know, with really, you know, educated men in the past and so on, Pan has always kind of crossed over that. And he's, for a long time, he's been part of popular culture, whether through, you know, fiction in the later 19th and early 20th centuries, or, you know, more to getting into our present day, the world of comic books and things like that. I think he is that kind of god that, you know, he kind of crosses over boundaries and has a very wide appeal, I think.
That thing about him, that he crosses boundaries, like he's so clearly, he's a sylvan god, right? He's a very in nature god, but he makes this crossover into high culture. And that's one of the things that I found most fascinating about him while reading your book. So that's something I really want us to explore. So I think, let's start there at the beginning. Where does he come from? Like when do we first hear about Pan? Where is he and what's he like?
Yeah. He's first heard of in ancient Arcadia, and that's Arcadia is a region in the Peloponnese. It's kind of a wild region. It's mountainous. Agriculture is challenging there, and the ancient Arcadians were looked upon by the other Greeks as being older than all the other Greek nations and peoples and things. And the Greeks described them as older than the moon, and they were believed to speak a much older form of Greek. And they had some habits that the Greeks regarded as really kind of outlandish. They ate acorns, and they relied on herding sheep and goats rather than farming to the extent that other Greeks did. Now, they did have towns and things. They weren't sort of living out there in the woods, but the Greeks regarded them, the other Greeks regarded them as really backwards and kind of out there. They don't seem to have written very much down apart from some inscriptions. And the first Arcadian references to Pan are little bronze figurines of shepherds that are dedicated to Pan, you know, thanking him for, you know, healing or gifts or something like that. And although we think of shepherds, you know, as you know, perhaps kind of poor figures out there in the countryside, these bronze figures are very well carved. Bronze was fairly expensive, and so it suggests that, in fact, some of these Arcadian shepherds were fairly well off. But beyond that, we don't actually have any visual depictions of Pan very early on. It's really not until the 5th century when Pan's worship leaves Arcadia that we start to get visual depictions of him. And we see him on vases where he is portrayed in a recognizable way with goat's legs and hooves. He has horns. He has the torso of a man. But the very early ones depict him as having a goat's face, which kind of that varies over time. Sometimes his face is very human in ancient sculpture. Sometimes it's more goat-like. Again, it's not until his cult leaves Arcadia that we start to get these images of him. And so there is a question about that, whether the Arcadians thought of him as having this appearance, or if it's a kind of outside point of view on Pan that really wants to connect him to that world of herding and pastoral life.
Sure. So, like that's more of a commentary on what the rest of the Greeks thought about the Arcadians, maybe.
Yeah. And then after that, we have Arcadian representations of Pan. You know, there's a really wonderful bronze image of him with his eyes over his brows, and he's clearly watching over a flock. You know, we might imagine him on a mountaintop or something looking at the sheep, but he really seems to have been a protector of the flocks and a healer and a really kind of positive a positive force. But he very quickly acquires associations with fear and panic. And our word panic does come from Pan, and it's that sudden experience of terror, right? That, you know, we live in a time where, you know, panic attacks are something that a lot of modern people experience in response to the very challenging world we live in today. But that feeling of panic is kind of it's a primordial Pan experience. And it may well go back to his earliest origins, although it's recorded a little later. So that's kind of where Pan starts out as, you know, the goat foot god, the protector of flocks, who early on becomes associated with this feeling of panic. And his cult kind of spreads from there and eventually spreads throughout the ancient world over time.
So right away, nature, but kind of scary. Well, nature is, I guess. And when do we get the pipes?
The pipes appear visually very early on. He's often depicted holding his pipes. One of the interesting things about Pan, and it's something that makes him a little different from the other Greek gods, is there aren't a lot of myths surrounding him. Like, so we don't really have any idea what precisely the stories were that were told about Pan early on. He's kind of on the periphery. Probably the most famous myth about Pan, though, is about the pipes, and it's recorded by this Roman poet Ovid in his collection of myths called the Metamorphoses. And in it, Pan is smitten with a young nymph named Syrinx. And in his pursuit of her, she flees to a river, the nymphs who live in the river help her out. They transform her into a reed, and Pan reaches for her, and she suddenly turns into a reed, and he's frustrated, and he's sad, and he cuts the reed, and he makes the reed into his famous pipes. And that's the origin of those. And he plays a sorrowful, melancholy kind of song that is traditionally associated with the music that, that Pan plays. And if you ever hear, and you can go online and find contemporary examples of people playing the syrinx or panpipe, it is a very haunting, very kind of melancholic and even eerie sort of instrument. And it does seem to fit well with Pan.
Yeah. And there is something kind of mystical, and that's another like enchanting and sorceling, which is a thing that, that comes up a lot as well. That, that makes sense there. Okay. So we have him in like the classical world. We see this and we have a grasp on him. And he kind of disappears for the general audience in the Middle Ages, mostly. Yeah,
yeah, he does. He's there are pagan gods who sort of survive through the Middle Ages. You know, Chaucer in his Canterbury Tales. He, you know, in the Knight's Tale, we have references to Saturn and several other gods. But Pan is not one of those gods who is much remembered in the Middle Ages. It may be that his associations with lustfulness and those kinds of connections made him a little too earthy and pagan for medieval Christian writers. But he doesn't resurface really until the Renaissance, where there's a rediscovery of pagan antiquity and all its kind of richness.
Yeah, you mentioned a couple of like manuscript drawings, but that's going to be, you know, those are going to be monks with access to a different sort of literature.
Yeah, and right, there's a really fascinating one. There's a manuscript image that shows the 12 tribes of Israel kind of standing around in the desert. And on the other side, because they're traveling, taking a break. And on the other side of the image, there's a palm tree and a monkey. And below the palm tree is our friend Pan, and he's standing there, and I believe he has his pipes with him, and it's not really clear what's going on. One interpretation of that image is that the monkey, for medieval people, was a symbol of lust, and so Pan might represent the temptations of the flesh. I think the more likely interpretation is just that it's the wilderness. You know, and that's kind of the biblical story of the 12 tribes wandering through the desert is a story of wandering through the wilderness. And Pan is the god of the wilderness. And so he makes his little appearance there. But this is a very rare appearance. And apart from one other image where he's standing beside Venus, the goddess of love and sex and all those things, he really doesn't appear. I wasn't able to trace any other appearances of Pan in the Middle Ages. So that's really about it.
Yeah, and that is somehow even more interesting. Like, no images, cool. Tons of images, okay. But two of them is, you know, and probably there's a couple more maybe out there that we haven't found, but that's very interesting. He's got some cachet, but really limited.
It suggests to me that it's not that medieval writers who were overwhelmingly, you know, in the church, particularly in the earlier parts of the Middle Ages, it's not that they didn't know about Pan, but that they didn't want to dwell on
right.
Pan.
You know, Pan's best left in the past.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's best left in the past. I think that's fair. Yeah.
Yeah. But then he makes a strong comeback in the Renaissance, right? Art and philosophy, back to high culture again. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The Renaissance kind of rediscovers this other side of Pan, which also has, deep roots in the ancient world. And it has to do with a confusion or perhaps even a punning on Pan's name, which is All. So Pan's actual name derives from a root meaning pasture or to pasture. So it has these really deep pastoral associations. But there's another Greek word, Pan, and it's familiar with us today. It's the root of pandemic, you know. It means everything. It means all. And because they're kind of homonyms, and the ancient Greeks liked that kind of wordplay, but they may also have thought the two words were really closely related. They identified Pan as the god of all. So he kind of acquires this second identity. He's the god of shepherds and flocks and terror and lust and all those things. But he's also this cosmic god of everything. And in later antiquity, different schools of philosophy kind of adapted this, and they really elaborated on this. And so there's an ancient Orphic hymn that members of a mystery cult devoted to Orpheus, somebody in that wrote it, and it kind of enumerates all the different aspects of the universe in connection with the different parts of Pan's body. You know, so it, maybe his horn is the moon, the spots on his cloak are the stars, and things like that. And that's really the Pan that's rediscovered in the Renaissance. It's this cosmic Pan who's god of everything, and he's not as earthy, he's not as physical, and he's not as connected to the wild as this other side of Pan. But you know, the Renaissance humanists in Florence and elsewhere, they were intellectuals, they were philosophers, and they were intrigued by this figure of Pan as a god who could embody everything, all of the elements, all of the elements of the cosmos, the stars, the sky, the planets, and everything else. And so this becomes another important aspect in Pan's identity that later writers will return to.
This is great. Yeah, he's a very complex character. And then let's just add another dimension of kind of what I'm considering like interesting weirdness is that he gets linked with the death of Christ sometime.
Yes. Yeah. Right. We have to mention the strangest and maybe the most distinguishing thing about Pan's whole ancient career, which is he dies. You know, other ancient gods died and came back to life. I mean, Dionysus does this in his mythology. Adonis is killed and he comes back every year and he dies. And, you know, there are some affinities to the way, Christ's story was adapted early on with those. But Pan just dies. And this goes back to a report that Plutarch, who appears to be a writer who, had a great deal of integrity and checked his sources and everything else. And he reports that a sailor in the time of the Emperor Tiberius was on his boat and he heard a voice call out to him. And it said, Tamas, the name of the sailor, go tell the world that Pan is dead, essentially. And he then heard, you know, this cry that Pan was dead. And so he was very shaken up by this, but he spread the word, and it reached the ears of the Emperor Tiberius, who was so concerned to hear that Pan had died that he actually sent out some of his counselors to investigate this. And they concluded that Pan had died, in fact. And that's kind of the whole story, except in reality, worship of Pan did not die out. And a century later, a Greek writer is visiting, named Pausanias, is visiting ancient Greece, and he finds Pan's shrines are all still open. Locals still claim to hear the sound of Pan's pipes eerily playing in the wilderness and so on. And so this question of whether Pan really did die also enters into this tradition. Later Christian writers took the death of Pan as in a couple of different ways. One was maybe the obvious way that it shows the pagan world is dying now that, you know, Jesus is born and all of that. But the other way was a little more generous towards paganism in that it took it as Pan as a symbol of Christ, that in some sense Pan and Christ were identical, as though this was a way for pagans to slowly understand the reality of Christianity and so forth. But by and large, Christian writers tended to classify Pan along with the other pagan gods as demons, and so his death was sort of vindication of their worldview. Yeah,
fair. Which makes some sense. But yeah, let's. I'm glad you brought that up. I might have forgotten to ask about it. He dies, which, as far as I know, is like that part of the definition of God is eternal, right? Like being eternal.
Yeah.
Not man. Yeah.
No. Very odd. And there are a lot of weird things about the story. to me, one of the most obvious is there's no account given of how he died or, you know, any details at all. Some writers like Robert Graves, and I don't know ancient Greek, so I can't comment on this, but some writers like Robert Graves have argued that in fact, there's a misunderstanding and that it was not saying Great Pan was that at all. But it was rather worshippers of a god named Tammuz who happened to have a very similar name to the sailor, who were simply saying that Tammuz had died. And Tammuz was one of those gods like Adonis who just kind of, you know, returned every year. So it may have been some confusion that's at the root of all that.
Or symbolically, you know, that we've got this Pan depicts kind of all of nature. Nature is dead and paganism is dead. This makes sense. Yeah. So post-Renaissance, he's really embraced by the Romantics. Why is that? Like, how so and why?
Well, I think the main reason that Romantics embrace Pan is that he is the god of nature. And the Romantic movement was really, an opening up to nature and a turn towards nature as a source of meaning, as a source of beauty, as a way for people to really discover their authentic selves. And so Pan as the god of nature has some real importance there because he is this kind of mysterious embodiment of the world of nature. One of the things I was sort of fascinated by as I was reading the Romantic writers on Pan is that they really tended towards the more philosophical Pan. You don't get a lot of Romantic writers portraying, the goat-footed god lustily pursuing nymphs through the woods or anything like that. They really take a view of Pan as, you know, the embodiment of nature, as the embodiment of the cosmos. But I think one thing that's consistent is the sense of awe that we experience in Pan's presence and the way, you know, an encounter with Pan takes us outside ourselves and really brings us to a recognition that nature is other. You know, it's other than us, and yet at the same time, we're a part of it. You know, it's like it's a recognition that we're part of something much greater than ourselves, and that our ordinary sense of ourself is very limited. You know, it's isolating. So Pan is a way of kind of connecting with the wider natural world in some sense.
And then this theme of awe that is running through. So let's stop in now with Kenneth Graham. All right. And the author who listeners all know is the author of The Wind in the Willows, right? Which is another incredibly personal favorite book of mine as a child too. So what's going on? When starts his relationship with Pan a little earlier, right? 1894.
Right. So Kenneth Graham, he writes a collection of kind of miscellaneous pieces. He gathers them together in a book called Pagan Papers. And, Graham clearly comes across as a kind of almost a nature mystic without too much mysticism, I think, in that collection. But he likes the pagan world. He likes the sensuality. He likes the natural world and so on. And at the time Graham is writing in the 1880s in the decades that follow, Pan has also become a god who's really embraced by gay writers in particular as embodying, you know, kind of an alternate sexuality. Because Pan, in the ancient world, Pan pursued, you know, men and women or nymphs and humans, males as well as females and all that. He was almost pansexual in the sense that we use that term today. And so Pan became a figure that gay writers kind of embraced as a symbol of alternate forms of sexuality and so on. And Kenneth Graham's sexuality is a real mystery. He clearly preferred the company of men. Some recent biographers suggest that, you know, he had some long-term relationships with men and you know, even lived with one partner for many years. There's some controversy about those things, but he's clearly drawn to Pan at a time when Pan has these really charged associations. In the pagan papers, Pan appears as a very rural, very English kind of god, you know, the sort of god you might run into on the village green or down at the pub or something like that, right? So he acquires this other close connection with Englishness as well. And then in Wind in the Willows, and maybe we'll focus on that here. Kenneth Graham had written the book, and he added this chapter in, The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, after The Wind in the Willows had been completed. And in it, the water rat and the mole are looking for a baby otter who has gone missing. And they're rowing down the river searching for this baby otter. And they're suddenly overcome by the sense of awe and mystery as this music, these distant pipes begin playing. And they enter into a kind of mystical state as they arrive at this island. Yeah, right. And they're overcome by awe and wonder, and they discover a figure who's never named as Pan. He's just named as the Piper at the Gates of Dawn. And there he is as the sun rises, and the little baby otter is between his hooves. He's protecting them. And they realize that this figure, the Piper, is dangerous. He's powerful, but he's also a protector. And they bring the otter home and sort of live happily ever after. And they have no memory of this encounter with the Piper at the Gates of Dawn. But it is a remarkable chapter, and you really get a feeling for Graham's kind of pagan mysticism in this chapter. And as I mentioned in the book, in a lot of American editions of Wind in the Willows, this chapter is expurgated. It's just not there. And you know, there is a lot of conservative religious feeling in the United States, and the Piper at the Gates of Dawn is unapologetically, inexcusably pagan. It's absolutely
no other interpretation, right?
Yeah. And it has the advantage from a censor's point of view of being detachable from the story, because it's not really integral to the plot. One of the things that's fascinating about it is that Kenneth Graham included it. You know, he had a complete story. It's not really necessary for the plot, but for many readers, including myself, growing up as a child reading the book, it is the most magical part of the story. It's in some ways, it's the heart of the book, even though the main plot is about, you know, the crazy antics of Mr. Toad and his car and his friends trying to stop him. So it's really extraordinary what he does there.
Yeah, there's something about it. So I read it today for the first time. The book I had as a kid did not include it. I read about it in your book, so then I purchased it and read the chapter today for the first time. So I'm like newly excited about it. I feel like I was like 12 or something and reading it for the first time. But I love the way it allows us to get like more into the relationship, that incredible, beautiful homosocial interaction between mole and rat, you know, and how much they love each other. And they're good buddies, and they're off on this adventure. And how mole can't hear him at first, like rat hears him and mole follows, which is significant somehow, I'm sure.
Right. And I think that, you know, those homosocial bonds between the animals, and The Wind in the Willows is really an all male world. It's a world about male friendships, male kind of intimacies. And there are some contemporary interpretations of the book, read it as a kind of coded gay novel in some ways. But I think regardless of how we read it, it is a homosocial book. It's about men's relationships with each other. And so Pan is this deep, incredible, meaningful experience that really brings and sort of symbolizes this deep relationship, this deep affection that mole and rat have for each other. Absolutely.
Really, yeah. Sweet. And then the awe and fear they feel, which is really compelling, you know, which is the kind of how you've get us to almost the end of the book, is this, you talk about him as this powerful and familiar occult figure, which is a way he spans kind of across time as well.
Yeah, right. And the occult side of Pan is a really fascinating one. I think a whole book really could be devoted to that side of him. We might trace its origins to the Orphic hymn that I mentioned, this ancient way of invoking the god. The Orphic hymns are really interesting because they begin with a little sort of note talking about lighting the incense and doing all of these things. So they were clearly ritual poems. They were ritual invocations of the ancient gods. And so the Orphic hymn to Pan is an invocation of the god Pan. And in the late 19th and early 20th century, there's an occult revival, the most famous organization being the Order of the Golden Dawn. And lots of people belong to that. The poet W.B. Yeats and the beast himself, Aleister Crowley, being among the most famous members. And they are really connecting back to Renaissance traditions of high magic, which in turn were really reviving the kinds of magical practices, ritual practices that were engaged in the ancient world. Crowley in particular was attracted to Pan, partly for some of the homosocial reasons we were talking about earlier, but also because of the way Pan combines this sort of lustfulness with this kind of cosmic power. And so Pan becomes a really central figure in the writings of Aleister Crowley and his system of magic that he called Thelema, one of the stages of which is to enter into the Night of Pan, where the ego is shattered and all of this. And he himself conducted numerous rituals involving Pan, including a famous one in the desert with his kind of acolyte, Victor Newberg, which involved performing a sexual rite to connect with the god Pan and enable him to continue this larger magical ritual he was conducting. But Crowley was only one of many. Another prominent modern thinker in occult circles is Dionne Fortune, and she was also a member of the Golden Dawn, kind of in its later, more fragmented form, but she wrote a fascinating novel called The Goat-Footed God, and she also developed her own ritual, and the ritual and the novel are connected to invoke the presence of Pan. And so so for these kinds of modern occultists, Pan is a source of esoteric hidden power rooted deep in the natural world and the cosmos, a power that can be invoked through ritual, through ceremony, through words and language. And that's a really kind of central part of the modern occult tradition. But he also has an important role in the revival of witchcraft that starts in the 1950s with Gerald Gardner and this notion of the horned god that goes back to a writer named Margaret Murray in the early 20th century, believed that witchcraft was an ancient cult devoted to the horned god, of which Pan was just one of many embodiments. Murray's thesis about witchcraft is no longer accepted, but it was very influential in the development of Gerald Gardner's Wicca. And so this horned god of modern witchcraft becomes identified with Pan. And so all of those ancient traditions and associations with Pan kind of make their way into those more modern kinds of traditions as well. So he's a central figure in modern occult thought as well.
And the horned god then becomes that, I mean, that's the devil, right? In some, there's some linkage there, not all over, but yes.
I think like a lot of people who've thought about it, my assumption was that the form of the devil, his familiar form, was really just the early church taking over Pan's appearance and saying, look, this powerful pagan god you all love is really just the devil. And one of the things I discovered as I was writing was that, in fact, as we talked about earlier, Pan was really absent in the Middle Ages. They weren't that interested or concerned about him. And it's really not until the 19th century that you start getting this close identification of the form of Pan and the devil. Before that, the devil is usually portrayed as this kind of monstrous assemblage of bits and pieces from all different animals to kind of, I think, to illustrate how unnatural he is. You know, he's rejecting the natural order of things. But it's really not until the 19th century that this identification becomes really strong. And modern writers often play with that. You know, the question of whether Pan is really evil or whether Pan and the devil can be considered in some sense one is really something that doesn't enter into the kind of collective imagination until the 19th and 20th centuries.
Yeah. You know, I was thinking about Neil Gaiman has the new Sandman is out. Right. And I'm thinking about, so Gaiman's been on my mind quite a bit lately, which to be honest, he always is. But I'm thinking about his Sandman, well, like not the Sandman, his version of Lucifer as well, and how that Lucifer that's so compelling and beautiful and incredibly sexual and a little dangerous is very much like a Pan-ish kind of deity as well. He's a really useful character.
Yeah, I think it's kind of a two-way street. So we have some modern portrayals of Pan which really make him out to be very devilish. There's a wonderful it's available on YouTube. You can watch it. This wonderful scene from a 1926 film by Rex Ingram. His name has just slipped my mind, but in it, Pan is portrayed as the devil. He's presiding over hell, and it's, you know, it's really eerie and so on. But I think it's a two-way street. We start to see portrayals of the devil as a sexier seducer kind of figure, a little playful, a little mischievous. Some of those qualities that, you know, maybe we're more closely associated with Pan in the past. So there's an interesting relationship between those two. And I think it's also a relationship that shows the kind of continuing discomfort with Pan, right? I mean, Pan is always a disruptive influence. He's always outside our day-to-day experience and our sense of really normalcy and our conventional sense of right and wrong. So I think in a way it makes sense that Pan is connected with the devil in some way, you know, that we realize that the two figures are raising perhaps similar moral questions, and questions about our relationship to our own desires, the relationship between sexuality and morality and so on. Questions that people continue to think about and struggle with a little bit.
You know, I think that might be the answer to it, because this is my final question. The last thing I really wanted to think about is why he, you know, because where we are with Pan is he's still everywhere. He's more places than he's ever been, right? So, you know, kind of what is it? Why are we so fascinated with this character?
I think we're still fascinated with this character because he is such a transgressive figure, you know. So some more contemporary portrayals of Pan, taking, for example, a feminist perspective, kind of approaching that, some of the mythology, like his pursuit of Syrinx and so on, in a more critical way, but emphasizing the way that his behavior really is transgressive. Like we can't, even the mythology that has perhaps grown more familiar over time is really showing Pan as a transgressive, dangerous figure. And I also think that because of Pan's role as a god of the natural world, our current moment of climate crisis, of ecological collapse, of the diminishment of the wild, you know, the threat to the Amazon and all those kinds of things, make him a figure who's really urgently relevant. You know, he is always the embodiment of nature beyond the human. And as human beings facing climate catastrophe, we need to come to terms with that. We have to find ways not only to live alongside that, but actually to preserve the wild that centuries ago was simply a threat to human beings or a mystery. Now it's become something that we need to really engage with and protect and value.
Yeah. All right. Great. That's an excellent answer. And it helps me make sense of this very compelling character. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
You're very welcome.
So listeners, you've just been listening to me talk to Paul Robichaux of Albertus Magnus College about Pan, The Great God's Modern Return, Reaction Books 2021. It's available from fine booksellers everywhere. And you can also click through on the link at our New Books website. All right. Thank you. And ciao.